A state's archives are often described as a treasure chest. Who knows what you're likely to find as you delve into the innards of a nation? Well, this was certainly true for Frank Dakota, one of the world's most distinguished China scholars, now Chair Professor of Humanities at the University of Hong Kong. Over a decade ago, the Chinese Communist Party made quite a startling decision, given their caution about transparency, to open up local archives, making available previously classified party documents and details of how Mao's Cultural Revolution truly affected ordinary Chinese, farmers, small business owners, even children whose accounts are documented of something that began 50 years ago this year. Professor Dakota's use of this work resulted in a trilogy of books, Mao's Great Famine, The Tragedy of Liberation, and the most recent, The Cultural Revolution, which, as part of his virtually annual book release, is considered to have fundamentally changed our general view of China. He's in Australia for both the Melbourne and Brisbane Writers' Festivals, which gives us the chance to talk to him about his work and about the current situation in Hong Kong, his current base, where, of course, there were very big demonstrations again last week. So, Frank Dakota, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to Australia and to Saturday Extra.
Delighted to be here.
What do you think possessed the Chinese Communist Party to make public the country's archives? And was it a bit of a surprise to you that they did do so?
Well, it took place very gradually over many, many years. So during the late 1990s, material on the Republican era before 1949, when the red flag went up over Tiananmen Square, over the Forbidden City, became available. And only very gradually was the material under Mao opened up. So it was very gradual, a little bit surprising, but not entirely, in that local Chinese historians complained that they had to go to Moscow to read about the history of the People's Republic of China. And I think that was probably quite instrumental. Besides the fact, of course, that there are plenty of laws that say that people have this or that right.
Right.
But they're all on paper.
It's just that it allowed you all to look into the horrors of that time, which they knew were there. Did they, A, not care, or B, decided had to be exposed?
Well, it's a very big country. So when archives are allowed to start declassifying material, of course, some of them are bound to take it too far. So the story really is one of finding material before an inspection committee sent by the Central Archives from Beijing closes it down again. It's a sort of cat and mouse game. So the great years were up to the Olympics in 2008, when there were vast amounts of material to be seen, to be read, extraordinarily detailed investigations into cases of cannibalism, for instance, during Mao's Great Famine.
Leap forward.
Absolutely. When, for instance, the Public Security Bureau investigated a village and came up with the names of 50 victims who had been cannibalized by the villagers, with the names of the perpetrators, the manner in which the body was consumed, extraordinarily detailed, given that frequently we do not have any real hard evidence for cannibalism during the Great Leap Forward. So you can imagine how much was in there. But the moment you find it, frequently you go back a year later and that material has been reclassified. And right now it looks rather bad, I should say.
That was my next question. Given Xi Jinping seems to be very much a control freak, if I can put it as basically as that, is it now under wraps again?
Well, absolutely. He came in and made it very clear right away, 2012, that any attempt to look critically at any one episode of the history of the Chinese Communist Party is tantamount to committing the crime of historical nihilism. Now, I still don't know what it means, historical nihilism, but it sounds suitably intimidating. It sounds rather bad. So it's gone downhill ever since. And right now, there are historians in Shanghai, professional historians who've dedicated their lives to looking at the history of the Communist Party of China, who've been told not to publish anything or they will lose their social benefits. And pensions if they are retired.
My goodness.
That's where we are right now.
And just in case people, because I think this is often can be quite confusing, the Great Leap Forward, of course, preceded the Cultural Revolution, didn't it?
Yes, yeah. Yes. 1949, so-called liberation, which is, of course, a tragedy. 1958 to 62, a massive famine caused by an attempt to turn every man, every woman in the countryside into some sort of foot soldier to work day and night in order to transform the economy, results in tens of millions of people literally beaten, starved to death. And then, of course, the Cultural Revolution 1966, pretty much up to the death of Mao Zedong himself, 76.
So before opening this treasure chest of the archives, you had concentrated on Chinese history between 1895 and 1949, the days of the last monarchy, and then, of course, fighting the Japanese, because you had access to primary sources, empirical evidence, which really interests you. So have you made a permanent shift now to this period of Mao? Does this period fascinate you more than your earlier work?
Well, what I've always done, I've always been evidence-driven, you see. So much about China is written from an ideological perspective that what fascinated me as a historian is to find stuff which he can use to tell a story. Now, the great story to be told in the late 1980s and 90s, when I just obtained my PhD, was the Republican era, pre-49, because so much material that we thought had disappeared, through the trials of war and revolution, whatnot with the Cultural Revolution, all of that material appeared to be still there. We could look at it. And then very gradually, I shifted across that 1949 divide, so to speak, because the archives were opening up. But the real question is, where am I going now? Now that the archives have closed down, that has become very difficult. What is there to be done?
Well, I just wondered whether you were in this position that Anthony Beaver was, who, of course, the great war historian, absorbed himself in all the archives of the Soviet Union into the darkest. I mean, it was sort of absolutely descending to the pits of human experience, just like you clearly have, with fathers in the Great Leap Forward, fathers forced to bury their children alive and so on. And he admitted it had altered him. It was it's like a travel into a descent into hell to do so. Do you want to get out of it?
Well, that's exactly what I thought when I published the final volume in my trilogy in May 2016, just over a year ago. I thought I've spent a decade, pretty much day in, day out, reading about this horror. There are, of course, good stories in there. In particular, the fact that during the last years of the Cultural Revolution, the chaos was such that ordinary people were actually able to undermine the command economy, to reclaim very basic freedoms, to take back their own land, to open black markets. That's a good story. But most of it was pretty awful. So I was quite ready to step back and do something different. But
have you made your mind up, by the way?
Well, I've been writing a book on the cult of personality, which is probably just the mirror image of the terror that dictators use. They use terror, but also they project their own image to create loyalty among insiders and the population at large. So that's what I've been looking at the last couple of years. But I think I'm quite happy to go back to China and give it another try, despite all the new restrictions.
Oh, well, good. That's very good to hear. Now, let's just stay there before we come back to Hong Kong about this cult of personality and how dictators in effect use, I think you've said it very cleverly, they use both magic and the sword. Well, it was Dostoevsky wrote that that's what a ruler always uses to keep power. And it makes, I suppose, one think, could it happen again? I mean, how fast, from your observation, can relatively orderly societies descend into this pit of degradation?
There's always the thing about lessons from history and the notion that history will repeat itself if we don't study it carefully, but nothing repeats itself. And I think we've drawn plenty of lessons from history already. We don't need any more lessons. So I think the risk right now, when you have people like Timothy Snyder, who publishes about dictatorship with very indirect references to Trump and others, I think the risk now is that we start trivializing many of the horrors that happened in the past, the Holocaust, Mao's Great Famine, the Khmer Rouge under Pol Pot, that we start trivializing that by comparing it to what we might see in negative terms in the United States, Europe, or other parts of the world. I think there's a great danger there.
Yes, well, it is interesting you say that, because you see people in effect comparing with known people like Adolf Hitler or Stalin or whatever as a means, it seems to me, of trying to personalize and make real the risks that they see. So it's entering a world that has often forgotten history. Do you forgive them at least for trying, or do you think that there are real risks in doing this?
No, I think a lot of the comparisons that are made with Adolf Hitler, with Mao, with Pol Pot, actually rather rarely, I think they show not so much an awareness of history, but an ignorance of history. And again, I think it trivializes the horror that people had to go through. George Orwell put it rather clearly, authoritarianism is a boot in your face and permanently so. Mm. Now, that boot may be there, but it's not to be seen in Europe or the United States.
At the moment.
That boot is very much there in China, in North Korea, in other parts of the world.
Okay, so you do think, do you, that if we wanted to examine where something might happen next that we can't foresee and which could be a horror, you do think, I mean, obviously North Korea is an obvious one, but you even think that China could be ripe for it, do you?
Well, most democracies, certainly in Europe and in the United States, have had a very long time to develop pretty robust checks and balances. But that certainly is not the case in the People's Republic of China, never mind North Korea or other still existing Leninist one-party states. They're not the only ones that are around. These parties, these Leninist one-party states, proceeded decades and decades ago to systematically eliminate all checks and balances on power. So they are very much fertile ground, if you wish, for some pretty unpleasant developments.
Look, it's been 30 years since the British gave Hong Kong back to China. And we keep hearing about these pro-democracy protests and these remarkable young sort of activists, one of Joshua Wong, who was sentenced to prison last week. Where is Hong Kong heading in your view?
Well, there is an over... Well, I don't know. That's the correct answer. I have no idea. I'm a historian. I work on the past. I find the present hard to interpret, never mind the future. We don't know where it's heading. The future is always unpredictable. We have, as historians, the benefit of hindsight to put it all together. But we don't know where things are going. When a man set himself on fire in Tunisia, nobody realized that that would be the start of that whole string of revolutions in northern Africa. Nobody predicted, not one expert predicted the fall of the Soviet Union. So we don't know. But there is an overwhelming sense of pessimism in Hong Kong, a feeling that the place is being very gradually crushed, that there is a united front at work that undermines every little freedom there is. And that the future is rather bleak. Yet, on the other sense, I think one must be aware of the fact that Hong Kong is a society of extraordinarily resilient people. It's a very diverse society. It is built up by layers and layers and layers of refugees who came from China during the Second World War in 1949, during the early years of the Republic, when there were massive purges, during the famine, during the Cultural Revolution, during Tiananmen Square, and on it goes. So let me put it slightly differently. You might say that despite 60, 70 years of efforts, the Communist Party hasn't really been able to crush Shanghai. So what are the chances of that happening in Hong Kong?
Okay, we'll leave that as a marvellous open question, rhetorically put. Professor Dakota, it's really been a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And Frank Dakota will be speaking this morning at the Melbourne Writers' Festival and next weekend at the Brisbane Writers' Festival, including a conversation with RN's Anthony Fennell. And his books are published by Bloomsbury.